Father Time is not always a hard parent, and though he tarries for none of his children, often lays his hand lightly upon those who have used him well, making them old men and women inexorably enough, but leaving their hearts and spirits young and full vigor. With such people, the gray head is but the impression of the old fellow's hand giving them his blessing, and every wrinkle but a notch in the quiet calendar of a well-spent life. Charles Dickens had a fairly upbeat notion of the connection between graceful aging and a life well-lived, at least for some people. But why do some people age more gracefully than others? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How do social and economic status affect health? Do those at the bottom of the economic ladder have reason to be hopeful? Is there a connection between education and health? Our guest is Carol Riff, professor in the Department of Psychology at the UW-Madison and director of the Institute on Aging. She's also the head of a national study called Midlife in the United States, or MIDAS.
MIDAS, yes.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Nice to have you back. Well, we're all aging, so
yes.
It's a topic that everybody can be interested in. Tell us about this big study, the MIDAS study.
The MIDAS study was begun in 1995 with funding from the MacArthur Foundation. And the goal was to investigate the role of psychological and social factors in understanding the health of adults as they move across the decades of midlife.
Sounds huge, like a huge topic.
It's a huge topic. It was basically put together by a team of scientists from across the U.S., and it was unique in the scope of all of what was assessed. We had people participate in long telephone interviews, and they also completed really extensive questionnaires. And we learned many interesting things about how people basically are experiencing their lives as they move across the decades of adult life. We learned a lot about work and family life, daily stress, chronic stress, and how those things may actually be a part of helping us understand differences in people's mental and physical health as they move across these decades. And there was sufficient interest in the study and enthusiasm about it because it was just so big and broad that we were able to get support from the National Institute on Aging to do a longitudinal follow-up about 9 to 10 years later, and also bring even more content into the study so that we were able to collect information about many biomedical factors by bringing people into clinics and assessing stress hormones and inflammatory markers and cardiovascular risk factors, and even bringing people into laboratories for cognitive assessments and neuroscience assessments. So it became a kind of blend of experimental science in the laboratory with big population-based epidemiological type research.
And you have to go in without any assumptions?
To be in the study, are you?
No, I mean in terms of those conducting the study, do you go in with ideas as to what you're going to find?
The only assumption I think that motivated the study, and we had to have some assumption because I think otherwise we couldn't have been excited about the prospect of pursuing the study. But the only assumption was that we were confident that the psychological and social factors that we would be assessing. And these are things like people's personality characteristics, their sense of well-being, the quality of their relationships with other people, their sense of whether or not they have control over their lives, that those factors would matter, that those factors would be important predictors of or influences on what we saw in their health. And that was correct.
I was going to say, it seems fairly a safe assumption that somebody would be happier if they had some autonomy.
Yeah.
And how many people then did you study? Because I'm assuming you have to have a lot of people in order for it to have any significance.
Yeah. The original study was over 7,000 people, and they ranged in age from 25 to 74. It was a national sample, a national probability sample, and embedded within it was actually a large sample of twins that were also recruited from a national sample representing those same age groups.
Separated twins or just twins who had grown up in the same environment?
Both, mm-hmm. both. And the size of the sample was actually very important because we wanted to really make comparisons between people who were entering midlife, people who were in midlife, and people who were kind of exiting and moving into old age.
All right. Where are you going to draw those lines?
Well,
I have to ask.
It turns out your educational status actually is a big influence on where you think those lines are drawn. What constitutes midlife, for example? So we asked people in the study, when do you think midlife begins and ends? And it turns out, you know, if you're better educated and you have higher incomes and you're in better health, you kind of shift.
Later.
So you're still in midlife when you're 65. Whereas if, you know, you're high school educated, I mean, there's a kind of quickening of what happens over the life course. When you marry, when you become a grandparent, you know, many of those kind of punctuation points occur earlier among people lower in the socioeconomic hierarchy.
Why would education, do you think, make a difference in where a person thinks the midlife begins?
Well, this is kind of at the core of, I think, basically the story that is emerging about social inequalities and health in America. So people, in fact, live longer if they are better educated, if they are higher income, if they are have higher occupational status. And there is a phrase that is actually used in the research to describe this phenomenon. It's called accelerated aging. So that the onset of disease, for example, occurs earlier on average among the socioeconomically disadvantaged. There are exceptions to that rule, and that's a big part of what we're focusing on in MIDAS, is that, you know, being at the bottom of the hierarchy does not doom you to, you know, early disease and early death. And we're trying to understand something about why that's the case. What are some of the strengths that some people who are, let's say, educationally disadvantaged, that they don't fit that path. They don't fit that trajectory of succumbing to early disease, disability, and dying earlier.
Let me ask a question that might seem obvious in the answer, but is there that strong a correlation between education and income?
Yeah. But it turns out, yes. I mean, education is a good predictor of income. The people who are the, I guess, experts in assessment of socioeconomic status tend to emphasize the need for actually measuring both education, income, and occupational status, because even though they are correlated with each other, they are not equivalent. So you can identify people with high levels of income who did not go to college, for example.
And they still age more quickly than more educated people?
They haven't gotten
it.
As soon as you get into the science, what you realize is, you know, there aren't any really clean stories. They're all qualified. They're all messy or whatever. But in general, it is actually fair to say that there is a health gradient in each of those three indicators. You can find exceptions. And I'm personally very interested in the MIDAS data set in finding people who are in the data who are educationally disadvantaged, but their health looks good and their biological assessments look good. Whether we're talking about measuring their stress hormones or their inflammatory markers or their cardiovascular risk factors, they look good. They don't look like the average high school educated person in the data set. And then we bring other variables into the analysis to try to figure out why that's the case.
I was just thinking how many variables there'd be, because you'd have to look at nutrition, at genetics, at where someone lives, at all kinds of things. And then there'd be the risk of doing sort of a false cause and effect, you know, assuming that because someone did this, that must explain it. It must be very complicated, even in sort of figuring out who agreed to take part in the survey. Wouldn't you, just from the get-go, be selecting for the people who would agree to do a survey? In other words, let's say I'm a grumpy hermit.
Sure.
I'm a grumpy hermit. I'm not going to want to do your survey. I'm not going to answer the – I'm going to hang up on whoever calls. I'm not going to mail that survey back in. So you're excluding grumpy hermits from your survey to begin with. You know, I'm wondering, how do you figure
that in? That reality is a part of any effort to survey anything about Americans, including to do the census, that there always is a segment of society you can't reach. The underclass in America, people who are homeless, people who may be not at all interested in communicating with ivory tower academics.
Working too hard even to put in the time.
Working too hard even to put in. But what we can do is we can compare our sample with the U.S. Census, so that we can actually do some precise evaluation about how selective is the sample, how biased is the sample in a positive way. And it is, but the important thing is more than a third of the people in this study had a high school education or less. And that was fantastic, because actually for many people who study aging, a lot of the aging work is done with community samples of volunteers, and those people are not representative. They are not representative. So we made major strides, I think, in bringing into the field of aging the assessment of many of these psychological and social factors that had never before been comprehensively assessed in a really diverse sample, where diversity — I'm talking about diversity in terms of educational status, in terms of race and ethnicity, marital status, and so on.
So what was the age spectrum of the people you sampled in this aging study?
So we started with people who were 25 to 74. And a lot of the analysis in the first round of data collection kind of was broken out by five decades of aging, that we were interested in comparing people who are moving into midlife, and they're, you know, there's like early part of midlife, and then there's moving out of midlife. So we made chunks in the age variable, and then looked at, does that make any difference? And it turns out one of the important, I think, findings from the new data that we have collected — so we've now, we went back to these people 9 to 10 years later, and we found about 75% of them. And
that's a pretty high percentage.
That's high.
The fact that they're still alive, for one thing,
is pretty impressive. That was 75% of those who were still alive.
Okay.
Some had died. And the ones we found were positively select. I mean, that's true in any longitudinal study of aging. The people you're able to keep with you look somewhat better even at baseline in terms of their health and well-being. But there's still a lot of diversity. There's still a lot of diversity in the sample.
What was it that you really were after with the longitudinal study, with checking them after a 9-year interval? What did you want to learn
most? Well, this kind of comes back to the question of what's causing what as you track these people through time. And unless you have multiple waves of assessment of these things, you're in a very difficult position to infer any causal directionality in the links between psychosocial factors or health factors. So it was very important for us to do a longitudinal follow-up so that we could begin to look at, you know, who's changing in their health status over time and what might be some of the factors that would actually account for gains and losses in health status over time.
Are you also looking at not just how long someone lives, but the quality of life? In other words, there's that Greek myth where someone asks for long life but forgets to ask for good health, and then you can have a long, miserable life.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you measure sort of wellness? What factors do you consider when you're trying to look at, does someone age well?
Yeah. We ask many, many questions to basically try to get a handle on, is a person aging well? And we are, because many of the people who launched the study come out of the discipline of psychology or sociology, we're very interested in basically people's subjective evaluations of their lives. So it turns out you can ask a variety of questions about well-being. You can ask questions about your life satisfaction. How are you generally positive and upbeat and contented with your life? Those kinds of questions tend to fall under the heading of hedonic well-being, that you're generally feeling good about your life. I'm personally actually interested in a different kind of well-being that is referred to as eudaimonic well-being, which is a word that is traceable to the writings of Aristotle, who wrote that the highest of all human potential, the highest of all human goods is the realization of your true potential. I mean, he went to some length in the Nicomachean Ethics to make the point that happiness is not the highest of all human goods. It's more that you're living a life of virtue, that you're making use of your talent and potential, and it's your job to figure out what your talent and potential is. And
fulfillment, and is that the term?
Fulfillment,
that
yeah. Mm-hmm. Fulfillment. So we have actually a lot of questions in our study that get at whether or not people feel they are experiencing fulfillment. Are they? Do they have a sense that they are, in fact, developing their talent and potential? Do they have a sense that they are leading a life that has purpose and meaning and direction?
And some people, at least from the outside, it seems that they would peak early. I mean, you take the star college athlete, plenty of acclaim, success.
Yeah.
They graduate.
Yeah.
Or they go to the professional leagues last a couple of years. And then what do they do for the rest of their lives?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, so I've regained the thread of the point I wanted to make earlier. Following on your example of kind of a maybe like a rude awakening for a young adult, we have found in the longitudinal data, when we compare these assessments of well-being, both hedonic and eudaimonic kinds of assessments over this 9 to 10 year period, that the two most vulnerable groups in the study, vulnerable being defined as people who are actually losing ground in terms of their reported well-being, are the youngest and the oldest members of the sample. That we saw decline in the oldest members of the sample was not a huge surprise, because I'd done other work previously suggesting that the sense of purposeful engagement, for example, I think is actually a pretty challenging aspect of well-being for many contemporary older people, including well-educated older people. I think it's related to the fact that our society is not yet really ready for utilizing the talent and potential of the swelling ranks of older people.
Because of the mm-hmm. demographic bulge there.
Yeah, the demographic bulge. And, you know, and this is historically new. I mean, you know, this is the first time in the history of our species that we have people living so long.
And so many, such a big percentage.
And the question
of the population
is, you know, what can we do to utilize their talent and potential? It isn't just about providing adequate health care. I mean, people need to have something to do when they get out of bed in the morning.
And they need to feel valued. I mean, we have a very youth-oriented culture. And,
exactly.
You know, the images in the media, for example, and all the products that hide your aging would seem to me perhaps to play a role as well.
Yes.
It would be interesting to compare this study with something done in other cultures, other countries, to see whether there are differences that are determined in part by attitudes toward aging.
We are, in fact, doing a parallel study
in Japan.
Actually, we're doing one. It's called
heavy.
Midja, midlife in Japan, and we have a sample there of about 1,000 respondents. So it's not nearly as large as the Midas study, but it is a probability sample from the city of Tokyo. So we have a lot of variability, educational variability, even in the Japanese sample. And when we look at these various aspects of well-being, we went into it with the hypothesis that aging would be a more benign experience in Japan than in the U.S. because of traditions of filial piety. There's just much more – historically, there's much more reverence for, respect for, honoring of the elderly in the language, in forms of bowing. And so we expected – they also have, you know, national holidays to celebrate their elders. I mean, they do things that we don't do in this country. So we thought we would see actually some more positive signs of aging in Japan than in the U.S. And we did in some areas. We did find that when we measure the sense of I've created a scale called personal growth, which asks people a series of questions designed to get at, do you feel like you're actually making the most of your talent and potential? And that's a really important question, whatever age you are. There's no time in life in which I think that becomes irrelevant. And Japanese older adults were more likely to rate themselves high on that aspect of well-being than U.S. adults compared to younger age counterparts. On the other hand, Japan and the U.S. are both advanced technological societies. And in both of these cultural contexts, we also measure something called purpose in life, which is more about goals and objectives for living and the whole idea of, you know, feeling like you have a reason to get out of bed in the morning. And we find evidence in both studies that those are challenging aspects of well-being as people age.
If we go to the younger side of that spectrum, the 25-year-olds, and look at those in Japan, there is a lot of trouble there.
Yeah. I actually think the future action in this research, and we will be launching a new phase of the MIDAS study where we will recruit new members to the sample as well as continue with a third wave of longitudinal data collection. But I think the action actually is in young adulthood. I mean, there's just growing signs actually around the world of early adulthood being a challenging and difficult period of time. I mean, in this country, and Japan, and, you know, the economic recession is just wreaking havoc with the lives of young adults, even well-educated young adults. The opportunities are not there in the way that they were in the past. Young people can't even oftentimes envision that they will be able to do as well as their parents did.
Do you want to compare the work ethic in Japan or whatever you want to call it within the United States in terms of the happiness relative in each country?
Yeah. That actually gets a lot of attention, particularly in studies of achievement among school children, emphasis on achievement among school children. I'm not so sure the work ethic is the critical variable there. One of the things that I found very interesting from people who were doing cross-cultural research looking at performance in school among elementary school children and explanations for their performance, both by their teachers and by their parents. And one of the things that's, I think, unique about Japan, which represents what the social scientists call an interdependent culture as opposed to an independence, kind of self-oriented culture that we have here in the West, is that they had very different beliefs about people's capacities. So the normative belief in this was multiple Asian countries that were studied compared to what was going on in the U.S. The normative belief was every kid can do this. The normative belief was not, you know, we have some really talented kids in this class and we have some kids who maybe are not so talented and maybe some kids who have no motivation. But it's a different mindset that is actually brought to the educational task.
I'm wanting to ask about the differences you found between men and women in the study, and we'll follow that and some other questions when we return in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Carol Riff, who is the head of a national study called Midlife in the U.S., or MIDAS. And we're talking about, among other things, social inequality and the role that it plays in how gracefully or not people age. And this was obviously a big study, a lot of people involved, 9-year intervals in the study. And what all did you find out? What were the main things that you found out about social inequality and how that rates on the aging scale?
The theme of social inequalities in health predated this study. So it has been studied for several decades in research, population-based research in the U.S. as well as in other countries. One of the leading studies that kind of launched this whole area of work was called the Whitehall Study in England, and it was a study of it is a study of British civil servants. And a key finding related to social inequality from that study is that these British civil servants, all of whom had health care. I mean, so you couldn't look at this. So they found gradients in health, what that meant. And they weren't just about being at the bottom. It wasn't just that people at the bottom in the civil service hierarchy had poorer health. It was like every step up the hierarchy, you would see systematic differences in health status, which could not be explained by access to health care. So it kind of launched a whole field like, what does this mean? What does it mean that we have differences in disease, disability, dysfunction as a function of where you are in the job hierarchy in that world? And then it was extended to looking at educational status as a predictor of these inequalities and also occupational status. So the Midas investigators were very interested in that theme. I mean, we have scientists all over the U.S. working with this data and publishing from this data, and that is probably the primary topic on which we have the most publications, is looking at how do things like your educational status not just predict differences in rates of disease and disability, but fill in what fills in the intervening process. Like, how do we explain this? How do we explain this? So some of the things that we've looked at in Midas, for example, are links between education and health behaviors. So people who are lower in the educational hierarchy, on average, they smoke more. And they actually, that's not a surprising thing, although it's what is surprising is it's actually getting worse over time. The disparities in who's still smoking in American society. It's becoming more and more.
More of a class thing?
It's more of a class thing. And the Midas findings also indicated that lower education people who smoke seriously underestimate their health risks associated with smoking, which suggests there's insufficient awareness of the risks of smoking. But we also look at things like drinking, binge drinking, work and family stress, daily stress.
Self-destructive behavior, maybe?
Well, basically what we find is that these socioeconomic factors predict gradients in just about all of those things.
What about the factor of race, since we have a history in this country of racial inequity, generations of, you know, I guess, denying people access first to literacy and then to education.
Yeah.
So you've got generations of poverty.
Exactly.
How does that play a role here?
That is a theme in the Midas study. And one of the unique things we've done in Midas is recruit a city oversample. And what I mean by that is we knew we wanted to have a big presence of African-Americans in the study who could also participate in our biomedical assessments, which we do actually at three different universities around the country, one of which is UW-Madison. So we actually recruited to the study at the Midas II follow-up, we recruited about 600 African-Americans from Milwaukee to participate in the study. And that has been tremendously important in terms of our being able to actually document differences in histories of stress exposure. We asked questions about adversity in childhood in the study as well. And so there is a publication from the Midas study within the last year showing, not surprisingly, that comparing this African-American sample, which was mostly from Milwaukee, to whites in the sample that they had greater exposure of adversity, both in early life and adult life. But that was a meaningful predictor, a significant predictor of differences in a variety of inflammatory markers, which are precursors to cardiovascular risk. Another, I think, very important theme about race and health in America that is in the MIDAS study is that it comes back to this point we make over and over again. Health is not just about your body and your genetics and your biology. Health is about your mind, your life outlook, your subjective experience. And so thanks to the input of David Williams, who's a leading investigator of race and health in America, he's at Harvard, but he's actively involved in the MIDAS study. He brought into the study a measure of perceived discrimination. So to what extent are you going through life with the perception that you have been treated unfairly? And it's a comprehensive measure. I mean, it looks at discrimination in major events like being denied a bank loan, being denied a job promotion, big events that really define people's future lives, but also everyday events like being treated rudely and disrespectfully in a restaurant or whatever. So we have found that this measure of perceived discrimination predicts many of these biomarkers that we're investigating in the study. It feeds into people's actually biological risk factors. And I think that's an important part of saying race and health in America has to be understood from multiple levels. It is not just about poverty and disadvantage. It's also about the kind of psychological experience that people are carrying around that activates stress and pernicious biological processes within them.
Do the rich age more gracefully than the poor?
I would say you can find examples of exceptions to the rule, both among the poor and among the rich. So you can find examples of very privileged older people who have very negative life outlooks and, they have compromised health. They are, for whatever reasons, of less interest to me than the other counterpoint example. I am actually very interested in people who, in a socioeconomic sense, are disadvantaged. They didn't get the opportunities in life that, in the best of all possible worlds, we would want everyone to have.
So they're challenged, and how do they respond to that challenge?
Yeah, but they're actually, many of them are actually doing well, and it's protective of their health. So we just published a study recently, a graduate student working with me, Jen Morozenk, is the first author. And we just published a study in health psychology showing, first, that your educational status predicts your level of interleukin-6. Interleukin-6 is an inflammatory marker that's a precursor to many cardiovascular diseases. So, lower levels of interleukin-6 is better.
For the more educated, they have lower levels?
Yes. The better educated have lower levels. But that effect is moderated by your level of well-being. So that if you are high school educated or less, but you feel that your life is purposeful, you feel that you have a general sense of mastery over your life, you feel that you have a sense of growth, your level of interleukin-6 looks more like a better educated person.
Now, is that somehow the effect of having less stress? Sort of, does this show kind of the damaging effects of stress?
Well, that could be one pathway. I mean, it's a finding. Your question points to the fact that it's a finding that needs another layer mm-hmm. of explanation. But the reason I consider it such an important finding, and there's several like that in the MIDAS study, where, for example, the personality quality of conscientiousness makes it less likely that you would smoke if you're low education. Or having a sense of control makes it less likely that you would have poor health if you're low education. Or even maintaining active use of your mind through reading or writing or doing puzzles, that offsets the fact that education is a predictor of declines in episodic memory. Education is like predicting so many of these things. But
education is a predictor of declines in episodic
low education.
So likely to have memory loss if you're less educated.
Yes,
Your mind hasn't been honed as much, or you don't continue.
Finding is if you are using it. You may not have a college degree, but if you're using your mind, which you can do through, reading, writing,
crossword
puzzles, anything.
Sure.
If you are using your mind, you don't fit that profile of being a low-educated person who shows age-related decline in memory. So what I think is important about all of this is that these factors that I'm talking about, these life engagement factors, these psychological outlook factors, these are modifiable. Which means we're not going to be likely to be redistributing wealth in America anytime soon. I mean, the question is, how do you fix social inequalities? Of course, the number one thing I would like to see happen to fix social inequalities and their adverse effect on people's health is that we make educational opportunities much more widely available. That has to happen. For reasons of the research showing that, education is just such a powerful influence on these things. But
very complicated, though, to do that, to level that playing field.
Yeah,
there's many other outlying circumstances.
That's my point, that, it's so difficult to level the playing field in that way. It is less difficult, I think, to actually bring into high relief the fact that there are these strong psychological, social strengths that people have, they can be cultivated, that can really make a difference.
What about nutrition? In other words, if you're living on a fixed income or food stamps, you're probably not going to have the luxury of buying fresh fruits and vegetables and seafood to the same extent. And, I'm also thinking of neonatal health, neonatal health and the effect that that would have on someone from birth on. How do you track things like that in the study?
We don't have good assessments of nutrition because to do that well is really demanding. I mean, it would have to be a whole module. And we looked into it. We looked into, is there a way that we could do assessments of that that would be manageable given the burden that we already put on the respondents? So we can't assess it. But here's what I can say. Another thematic area of great interest in the study is obesity. What are the factors in this study that are predictors of obesity? And certainly the assessments of stress that we are measuring are predictors of obesity. But region of the country also predicts obesity. And we do have investigators in the MIDAS study who are interested in actually working with variables that are called neighborhood effects, that you can actually assemble information about the context in which people live and the availability of fresh fruits and vegetables in a person's neighborhood
context. So are you more likely in your neighborhood to eat buffalo wings or to have salmon sushi?
Yes, it's a huge part of understanding obesity in America is just availability, within what would be a distance that you can get to without having to use some form of mass transportation.
In effect,
what is available?
Neighborhood context.
Yes, exactly.
I would assume there's a lot of other environmental factors, such as the link between inner city dwelling and asthma, or just a lot of other things that have to do with where you're living, what kind of food you can have, and so on. One of the things that I had wanted to ask you about, too, is just looking at the global study for MIDAS, both the first one and the second one, are there any major differences that can be seen for how men and women age? Because we know women live longer.
Yes, which is, a great starting point. Like, let's explain that. What actually lies behind, the differential in life expectancy between men and women? We don't have people who are digging explicitly into that question, but we do have studies that point to different kinds of psychological and social strengths and vulnerabilities compared to men and women. So Women, it's actually well documented, both in MIDAS and in other studies. Women are at greater risk for depression and negative affect kinds of
low self-concept, compromised
well-being. On the other hand, women, we have many assessments in this study about quality of social connection. Social relationships are huge influences.
Women are pretty good at that.
And women are good at that. Women are good at that. You know, on all of those measures, women score higher than men. And in a previous study that I did with a much smaller sample, I wanted to kind of dig into that and try to understand, is that difference a difference that men even are aware of or care about? And is it just that, you know, women go through life with more kind of social sensitivity, social connections, social engagement? They are the caretakers in the family. Are men troubled at all by the fact that they may have less of this social stuff than women have? And so we did a study where we asked people to rate their well-being in various areas, one of which was called positive relations with others, but then also rate their ideal well-being. What kind of well-being would you like to have? And we found in that study that men have less of the social connection qualities that make life good than do women on average. You know, there are men who don't fit that profile, but on average they have less of it. And they idealize it as much as women. So it's you can't immediately conclude, you know, women are just wired differently and that's not something that the average male cares about.
You're saying that men want to have these connections, realize they don't have them, and somehow can't connect anyway.
Yeah. And some of the work also suggests that the social world, when we move from trying to link the social world to biological risk factors, some of that work suggests that the linkages are stronger for men than for women, which is kind of initially maybe paradoxical, but then maybe not when you back up and you think, well, the social world may be take up bigger space in the average life of the female, the wife, the mother. But that space is perhaps more complex and comes with both the upside of social relationships and the downside of social relationships.
I know I've seen in other studies, I don't know whether this is borne out in your study as well, but that the happiest people tend to be single women and married men. In other words, that marriage sometimes seems to be more beneficial for men.
Yeah, there is a line of work that has made that point. I think that likely varies by position in the life course. But
older single women may be happier than older single men, for example.
Yes.
We're going to look at twins and other aspects of the MIDAS study when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Carol Riff, and we're talking about aging, and in particular, a giant study called MIDAS, Midlife in the U.S., tracking thousands of people from the 20s to the 70s to see how they age. You mentioned that as part of this study, you also identified a whole group of twins. And I'm curious what kind of conclusions were reached.
There have been a number of studies with the MIDAS twins that look at heritability of certain outcomes. So using a twin design, you can actually come up with a kind of index of how much of your well-being or your personality profile is heritable or is due to environmental kinds of factors. And those studies, you know, kind of show that these many of these psychological and social things that we look at do have a heritable component to them based on twin designs. But it's not the whole story. It's not the whole story. So the important point, I think, with the twins is that in some ways it's not surprising that we find some evidence that some of these things are heritable. But the twins, I think, are going to become especially valuable to us in current and future work actually is by looking at environmental inputs on people who share a high degree of genetic similarity, especially monozygotic twins. So one of the things that becomes very interesting with the biomarker sample that we have, in which we've measured so many different aspects of like seven different physiological systems in which we've collected comprehensive measures, and where we find discordant monozygotic twins is really an entree into different environmental inputs.
Because they're identical,
because
obviously.
Because in a genetic sense,
twins.
They're identical, but they end up with different profiles of biological risk in mid and later life. And that gives us an opportunity to go into other parts of the data to actually try to explain that
in terms of
stress exposures. And I can't point to any specific findings that would have actually nailed that. I mean, we've begun to look at some of those things.
You mentioned earlier that you've got plans for, I guess it's going to be a MIDAS 3 sort of future studies. Tell us about that.
So in the next phase of the research, we will be continuing with the longitudinal follow-up of the existing sample. But an important part of what we're going to do in this next phase of the research is add another about 2,500 people to the study. And the primary reason for bringing these new people into the study, and they will be primarily young and the midlife part of the sample, not so much older adults, is because we have decided MIDAS is an incredibly promising study for investigating the impact of the economic recession on the lives of American adults in a very comprehensive way. So we know about unemployment rates. I mean, we know about mortgage foreclosures. We know about loss of health insurance and all of those terrible things that have happened in recent years. MIDAS gives us a way of linking those things, which we measure carefully in the study. We measure job loss, job discrimination, financial loss, bankruptcy. So we have a lot of measures of those kinds of variables. But what we can do is actually plug those things into what does that mean in terms of work, family stress, what work and family stress? What does that mean in terms of depression, anxiety, anger? And how are those factors then also linked to what we see in terms of biological risk factors? The stress hormones, the inflammatory processes. So we think we are actually very well positioned to make these comparisons because we have all this baseline data on those same kinds of assessments that were obtained well before the economic recession took over.
Well, an intriguing finding might have to do with the phenomenon of people who are financially well off in a recession.
Yeah.
Overextending and losing everything just
yes,
the same as
yes,
a poor person does.
Yes, yes, yes. So basically, you know, upward and downward mobility. I mean, notable changes in your financial status, even if you were middle class or upper middle class, I think will be very important things to look at and link to our mental health outcomes, our family relationship outcomes, and ultimately track the long-term consequence of those things. I mean, there is a world of scholarship out there that says these kinds of economic downturns have lasting consequences on the lives of young adults, not in terms of earning power, but also in terms of just self-fulfillment, self-realization, I mean, opportunities to basically live out their dreams.
There's a little bit of a flip side to that, it seems to me. I remember hearing years ago an interview with J. Paul Getty, who, of course, became one of the wealthiest men in the world, and asked what had spurred him onto that. He said it was when he was a youth and having to see his mother sell her silver.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there seem to be generational differences, too, where certain generations were used to kind of just, I suppose, the stiff upper lip or just, you know, not necessarily
Yeah,
defining
that's actually
themselves as
pretty well documented in the aging literature. You know, people who were children of the Great Depression just had a different take on, you know, what stress is or what adversity is.
Right. I have a personal question for you then. You know how sometimes you'll read a study on aging and it makes you think, oh, I should go have red wine or yogurt or, you know, everybody's looking for sort of the elixir, the thing that'll do it. After looking at all this data, Midas 1, Midas 2, the Japanese study and so on.
Yeah.
Do you come away from it thinking, oh, this is what I need to do to have a good aging process myself?
I actually make a point of saying to my students or when I'm speaking publicly that there is no elixir. I mean, and the search for, you know, a magic bullet, you know, taking you know, this particular new product as I think it preys on people's hope that if they do this one thing, they can somehow be guaranteed having, you know, a good old age. And I don't think that's how it works. Probably one of the primary messages from a big study like Midas is that no single factor in all of this, including socioeconomic status, no single factor is really like the big whammy. And what that means is the research, if the research is really going to get to a place where we really understand what are the factors that make a difference in people's health as they age, we have to recognize it's going to be different factors for different people, and they're going to come together in different ways that require us, I think, to in some ways accept the fact that the journey of aging, whether experienced positively or negatively, is the product of many things.
It's hard to get a headline or a soundbite out of a finding like that.
It is. It is, absolutely.
Yet I think I heard you say that education for sure
It
plays a role, education, which would be a good advertisement for lifelong learning
and
access.
And what I would say is what the findings in the study that I'm excited about, because much of health research in America is actually about illness. It's not about health. Because that's just our general approach to studying health. We study health by studying disease. And I'm actually interested in, you know, what are the factors that keep people from succumbing to disease? And so I would say the punchlines from Midas so far are that these psychological and social factors really have protective value. And they have been unrecognized, unappreciated. I think they are not targets of public health education. They are not targets of public policy. And these things can actually be promoted, you know, in ever larger segments of the population. And, you know, I think they're low tech. You know, nobody's going to get rich over, you know, this is not like the next elixir, the next drug. This is about, you know, people's perspectives on their own daily lives. And I think we can give people better tools for actually understanding what some of those resources are and how to tap into them in their own experience.
Well, Carol Riff, it's been a pleasure aging gracefully with you for the last hour. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can be with us for the next hour of University of the Air.